Welcome to The Solutionists, the therapy session your workplace didn't know it needed.
Stick with us. We have problems to solve.
Welcome back to The Solutionists podcast. I'm Bronwyn Williams, and with Sharon Pierce, we are The Solutionists, the authors of Survive the AI Apocalypse. And on this podcast, we unpack the dirty laundry surrounding the present and future of work. That is, uncover all the things that we all kind of know are wrong, but have not necessarily had the courage or the confidence or the clarity to be able to articulate what that problem is so that we can go and do something about it. This show is not just a show about complaints, though. It's also a show very specifically about solutions. So when we get into a topic about how work is not working, we also then try and look at how we can get it working again, because this is going to be imperative for our very economic and societal survival going forward, as dramatic as that sounds. Today, though, we have a guest, Ismay. We'd love you to introduce yourself, and then we'll explain to our listeners why you are here today, because you are not like our regular participants on the show. You are not someone who is inside the corporate maze. You're very much someone outside of it. But people within the walled garden need to listen to what Ismay has to say.
I'm Ismay, and I am first and foremost an educator, but I did take a few years off, or a year off, to become more of what I consider a educational philosopher. I like to think about what the state of our education system means, but most importantly, how does that impact the learners that we are producing and ultimately the citizens that we are producing for our country?
Well, exactly. Work is made up of people. People hopefully solving problems for other people. And those people, both the customer and the worker, are all products one way or another of the society that breeds and nurtures us. And one of the key ways, of course, we've been doing that is through our very industrialized schooling system, which is presently producing a particular sort of human being that has maybe some skills or lack thereof when it comes to actually being able to provide value to the rest of the world. Sharon, what is your take on this? And as someone who has spent a lot of time within the world of corporate, what are the challenges you see from like the demand side of the education pipeline that perhaps have not been fully understood by HR departments, by clients, by corporations, or even perhaps by the customer too?
My big frustration has always been, and I think it's catching up with us now, is that graduate programs are the silver bullet for organizations in producing the right pipeline. And while we're starting to see a slight shift to people saying, okay, we need to hire more graduates, there are a few in the news at the moment that are swinging the pendulum from not hiring to hiring. I still am not convinced that the solution is one-sided. And so there's a lot that has to be done in the education system in general, but also in the education system within corporates. And I don't think that we're geared that way. I think the way in which we're defining work and jobs is so functionally aligned. And if you roll that back to the education system, we're producing mathematicians, or we're producing arts peeps, or the integration gap is for me the biggest one that we have. We are not producing people that can think multidisciplinarily. I've always said that. I probably should be careful of what I say next, but I was married once to a scientist, and they always said that those of us that were doing a BA would be bugger all, and BSCs meant the world. And my big frustration was they weren't trained or taught to deal solutionism and or how to interact and engage in the right way. And so I still feel that even in the arts, we've got to be able to apply that in context. And that context is, for me, missing. And I think our entire orientation of education internally to corporations as well, and organizations, as well as externally, which is primary, tertiary, is geared far too functionally and not contextually. And I think we have to shift that narrative a bit. So that's my big bugbear. So we still have a grad program just for quants. We still have a grad program just for marketers. We still have a grad program just for accountants. And while we do need a level of specialism, because you can't be a CA without a board exam, I get all that. There's something about the broader context which makes the grads we're producing coming into organizations not as relevant as before, because they can't physically solution in a context. And that's what has to shift. And so the question is, do we even need half of the education systems we had? My mom was an immigrant, came to this country when she was 16, didn't speak English. But in those days, they had cooking schools and, you know, apprentice type orientated schools. My brother himself was an apprentice. And those guys produced physical, contextual, value-adding humans that were ready to take on something of need in the world. And I don't think we've got that anymore. I think we've lost it.
So from your perspective, the problem here is quite a product problem. We're producing the wrong kind of worker, unable to deliver the kind of value that is required by the market. From my perspective, there's a different problem here, and that's a pricing problem. So you're talking about the product problem. I think there's a pricing problem.
Probably
I think
a combination.
Education is far too expensive and delivers far too little value in general. So mine is a slightly sort of broader challenge, and have these sorts of debates with people often who have bought far too much education themselves, who think that the problem with education is that the degree is too expensive. I think the problem is we're spending too much time and money on education, full stop, which is a different argument. So people that have PhDs think that we should be paying for more people to get PhDs. I would contend, looking at data across the world,
we don't need them,
especially in the most developed parts of the world, which are ahead of the curve here compared to ourselves, that the return on investment to the individual and to society and to your parents and to your government and to the world at large has diminished to the point that I think that overall it might be producing negative returns.
Right.
So this is a different argument. And that's a bit a difficult argument to make in a South African context where you have many people who are undereducated. But I think we're still paying too much for that undereducation. I mean, you know, Esme, how much money we are paying to produce illiterate children. But that's a South African challenge. We spend too much money. We don't get too much. But even where there is surplus, we're spending too much time and too much money producing pointless education that does not yield value to society. And the big sort of data you can't ignore is when you start looking at people in the United States of America retiring with student debt. You cannot tell me that the solution to that problem is more education. You can't tell me that. So I think we've got a product problem. We've got a pricing problem. And Esme, from your perspective, what other problems would you add to the mix before we get into some of the solutions? We'll get back to that in a second.
It's a dangerous question. We were chatting about it earlier. I have this framework I call the stewardship versus extraction. And I think South Africa, we've, you know, all been raised with the idea of Ubuntu and the spirit of looking after one another. It takes a village, as you said. We've forgotten what it means to have to steward people or the potential in people. And that whole idea of like creating a product. And I always say the harvest always matches the seed. So you can't plant tomatoes and then expect to harvest a pumpkin at the end of the season. And I think this is what's happening in South Africa in the system is we're planting tomatoes. When we don't get pumpkins, we're like, oh, how did that happen? Ah, let's create another survey, which is a pet peeve of mine with this new survey that's come in for literacy. It's money that was spent for creating this really rigorous scientific survey to figure out why kids can't read. But we know why kids can't read. But yet we spend all of this money, all of this time, all of this effort trying to find sort of the root cause. And the root cause goes back to what are we planting in our classrooms? And I call it the pipeline disruption map, where we can trace this back to 15, 20 years ago with sort of the introduction of CAPS. And I always use CAPS as an example of maybe, you know, you have a baby, you have your formula, you have your breast milk, but at some point the baby has to transition to solid foods. And that's never happened with CAPS. And CAPS by, you know, default was designed to be something that gets everybody on a level playing field and then progress. And it's like arrested development almost, where our kids are stuck in this process of they're producing something, like you say, but then how do we get them off the diving board to go on to bigger, better things? And the education system around the world, I've taught in the States as well, is incredibly siloed. And that's when you're getting industry where people, you know, like you were saying, Sharon, only a BSc, only this, only that. Everything is so siloed.
Yep.
But you can't expect more because that's what 12 years of your schooling is. You do maths now for an hour, then you go to English for an hour. And at no point do they interconnect. So these brains of these little forming children don't learn to connect the dots to go, you know, in language. there's so much in language, that, you know, with linguistics, but then there's behavioral data involved with linguistics, but the kids are never being exposed to that. Right. And that then is, like you say, the product. But then the parents who are paying so much money and, you know, that phenomenon of exit over voice, where parents, as soon as they make a little bit of extra money in South Africa, all they think is take my kid out of the government school because that should be worse, and then put them in a really, really expensive private school because by default, the more I pay, the more I should be getting. But if you look at it, there was this really interesting study done by a UCT professor in the medical department. He had his med students, and he looked at graduates with an NSC and those with an IB and the dropout rate. I won't bore you, but he drilled down into the data because he saw that more NSC kids were dropping out than the IB kids. And when he drilled down a little bit deeper, he found that it wasn't the curriculum itself that was making kids drop out, or their lack of understanding or education. It was the fact that the IB kids, so our typical private schools in South Africa, their resources were the teachers, and more money was being plowed into the resource, which was the teacher, versus in the government school. And I thought that was really interesting data, because parents aren't looking at that. They're just thinking more money, better schooling, but those private schools aren't necessarily offering a better product in their services, other than maybe a more
human contact hours per
child.
Yes,
yeah. But even those numbers are high. It's 25 kids per teacher. That's a really big number. That's crowd control.
Maybe just to combine the pricing and the product problem, Bron, because I think we're saying the same thing slightly differently, in that what you're paying for and the value that's being produced are not what we need. But in some cases, is education even needed?
So, yeah, that's what I'm saying directly.
Yeah. So my mom, being a case in point, arrived in the country with like a standard six, but put me through school and university by cooking, as one example. I keep saying we live in a very entrepreneurial world, and there's like a baseline logic around survival that people then convert into value. So I always say, and you'll see it in the book and in most podcasts, I think I repeat this over and over, entrepreneurial society. Today, there's a rugby match, the dude at the robot selling the flags or whatever. That skill inherently of being able to identify a need, match it to a audience, put a price to it, and then feed your kids is actually the skill we need more of. And I think at some point we need to go back to basics. I'm concerned that we're not talking about parents and their roles. So aside from the fact that they produce the cash in order to educate, I don't know when last you went to a restaurant and saw a family eating dinner and every single person's on their phone. So the literacy problem exists in our very expensive private schools too, where kids are so used to not typing text, voice notes, like all that stuff should be banned. Like no one's reading or writing, actually. They're watching TikTok and producing movies. And so we have a village of people contributing to this issue. I mean, we haven't even got to the conversation around governments yet, but and poverty and the fact that people need nutrition. And I think at some point our pendulum needs to swing back to your point, whether it's government or private school. And just for the benefit of our international listeners, IB versus NSC probably requires a definition, but we have private schooling and obviously national and government-provided schooling. And I think what, Esme, you were trying to say is that really the quality of education or teachers in both those areas isn't necessarily different. Mm-hmm. To your point, the more money we're plugging into the wrong things, the more we perpetuate the problem we have. So, yeah.
The other frustration to add to that perspective is when you start getting to the demand side of the market, like whether that's a customer or a client or a company that's going to hire you, is that education itself, even pricey education at the tertiary level, at the primary level, is no longer a signifier of the quality of the product. That is the person that comes out the other end. Mm. Instead, what the signifier, the degree, the piece of paper is a ticket to upward mobility, but not through value itself. Actually meaning the education that we're buying at the schooling level, at the tertiary level, is valueless in and of itself. It's only valuable because of the status and access it buys your children or yourself. which means that plowing more money into state education or more money into education itself without the status component for it is not going to give upward mobility to the buyer of education. And it's also not going to produce quality workers to go into the system. So we have the status game where we might as well replace like university with like a country club membership. Everyone will have more fun. The benefit will be exactly the same to the person who has the ability to buy it. But then we're still left with the bigger problem, which is Sharon's problem, which is the world of work problem, which is where is the talent coming from? Where is the next generation of talent coming to actually build the world that we need, whether that's financial systems or farming systems or all the stuff that we need to keep society going? The point is talent is being stripped out and replaced with status games, which are not useful to society. They're only useful to the people who can afford to buy them.
Correct.
The concept of talent is quite an important one. And I think our definition of talent in corporations and organizations is flawed. We've been talking quite a bit, Esme, about work is not working. And I think the reality is that jobs are in themselves siloed, but we're hiring people for a profession versus hiring people for the ability to solve problems. And for me, that's a big issue. A job actually in the future is probably held by multiple humans and multiple people. And yet we are channeling everybody down a particular path. And so how we structure and what we call talent, talent may not be in the construct of organizations. You know, they talk about high potential. So people who have range and can develop a couple of levels higher than others. And, you know, there's this whole cognitive piece around it, which actually for me, there might be some truth to, but needs to shift entirely around what is the combination of humans I need to perform a piece of value adding or value generation for a receiver of that value in and defined by the receiver as opposed to defined by me. We're producing people for jobs that are themselves flawed in design. And so unless the entire system changes, we're a bit stuffed.
Well, to kind of square that circle, speaking about how people need to be able to work together to solve problems as opposed to purchase education to effectively buy a seat in a job. I mean, it's a very cynical Wall Street kind of way of working at the moment. But Esme, I know you've been working on, in the actual field, working with young children, trying to redesign the curriculum, maybe without permission, like trying to break down silos between the different subjects to produce children who can think holistically about solving problems, which sounds almost exactly like the solutionist model that our book is based on. And that's why we invited you here today, really, to talk about this. Like, it's to say we've all identified many different problems, but the solutions are all the same. It's getting people to start thinking again, right? And what are some of the ways we can help people to start thinking after we've spent a lifetime being taught how not to think? Tell us about your approach to solving the problem right at the beginning, right at the source, and then we'll come back in, Sharon, as to how we can compare and contrast this to the solutionist philosophy.
It's great. So I told Sharon earlier, I have a background in Montessori and Reggio Emilio, which is where a lot of my philosophy and understanding of integration comes from and how we teach kids. And understanding that kids aren't blank slates. I think that's where a lot of pedagogically it comes from. If you go back into the past, you know, other than your people like Dewey and stuff, a lot of people believe that kids were just blank and you were pouring into them. Like the jug, we call it the jug and mug in university.
So they're an AI algorithm keeping program.
Exactly. If they're using their phones, they probably are blank.
This is the point, right?
Well, we're making them blanker, I think, is the point, rather than making them more complete.
Exactly. Not giving them the tools. And that even in of itself is spread at university. So then I went later in life back to finish my B.Ed, and I was a good 10 years older than the majority of women, because unfortunately, foundation phase, just females, which is also another interesting dynamic, but a good 10 years older than them. They are also still so young in their passion and their love for education that they're so ready to be filled with stuff, the students, as it were, that a lot of this stuff from me being on the outside, having done Reggio Emilio and Montessori and having done that in the States too and in South Africa, I had perspective. So almost being able to tell the difference between what is like indoctrination without it being obvious. And this is what I've come to the conclusion is that everybody in the current education system has been indoctrinated in some way. What I noticed was there's a very specific type of person who becomes a teacher. So there's three, there's dynamics. So you have your foundation phase, your intermediate phase, and then your high school FET. all of those people have very distinct personality groupings. And a foundation phase teacher is very precise. You know, they like things just as they like them. I've known teachers in foundation phase to press stick things to their tables that they say precise like this. And it works because if you're working with such little children, that's kind of...
Yeah, it's structured.
Yeah, you're like, cool, I can do this. You know, you feel a little bit of in control. This is the framework around it. And so hearing something like, don't do jug and mug, you can do something else. But then the something else is still jug and mug. It's just called something different. And so that then becomes your template of how you're a teacher and how you teach kids to listen to you and do things exactly the way you do. Because allowing kids to learn on their own and to experiment and figure out their environment requires a degree of security in yourself and also understanding how people or kids learn. And so with what I've been doing now, and now I'm teaching grade six, which is completely foreign to me. I mean, I have nephews, so I'm not too jolted by it, but tell you, being in a classroom with 16 remedial boys is quite a shock to the system some days. And so that allows me also to like stress test what I'm doing and what I'm teaching with them, because this is the fertile ground. You know, this is where you can really make an impact. And so part of that, I have my school's permission, was to take the curriculum and to see how I could integrate it completely. And so I designed a 10-week framework. It's based on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at grade six. This is their set workbook. And so 10 weeks of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory as the anchor, but it's phenomenon based, which I've made mapped to the CAPS curriculum, because CAPS is all about a checkbox that you can just tick. Mm-hmm. And so I've made it to fit that. But essentially, it starts off with the driving question for 10 weeks is, where does chocolate come from and who benefits? And that's the driving question for 10 weeks long. And for 10 weeks, the boys are discovering from a chocolate, is a chocolate something delicious we eat, all the way to how to temper chocolate in science. So you're learning temperature, gauging that, what goes into chocolate to make it sweet, what makes it delicious, what stabilizes it, that it doesn't just randomly melt, you know. So all of that is being learned, all the way through to you learning geographical concepts. So latitude, longitude, how that affects where chocolate is grown. What do farming communities look like where chocolate is grown? Ethically, what does that mean? Is it sustainable? You know, and at the end of 10 weeks, they all made their own chocolate with their own recipe iterations that they worked through. Some chocolate just melted the minute they took it out of the fridge, and kids had to figure out how we're going to stabilize our chocolate to last for our little presentation, to writing 7 paragraphs of an ethical statement, which again is remedial. So this is huge, but it's because I didn't lower the water level. I came in, expected the best of them, and they rose to match it. And I think this is what happens in schools, is immediately the level is set, it's capped at a certain level, and kids can't surpass it, because the teachers also don't have the capability. If a kid comes in smarter than the teacher, it shakes them, because they don't know how to facilitate that learning, because they're supposed to be the all-knowing being.
No different in corporates with bosses.
I remember that. When I was 11, I had a teacher say, I can't teach you. She gave me Terry Pratchett and said, you can read that while I teach the rest of the class. So that was me done for the year.
Well, my teacher told me I was the most useless thing that had walked the earth and I'd amount to nothing in my life. So here we
are. Basically, school failed everyone.
Yeah. But my brother-in-law is a teacher, and what has really, a very good one. He's a beekeeper and wants to bring beekeeping into the curriculum and stuff. And of course, he's not allowed to. But one of the biggest stumbling blocks I find listening to him is that in most instances, it's not always the kids that are the problem. Parents are the biggest issue in teaching today. And a lot of people who are really good at it and do the kind of things that you do, are creative, who have the ability to think beyond the CAPS box and the admin that has been sort of imposed on teachers who are not, you know, the good ones, who are not administratively inclined, who are actually discovery focused, who are, you know, let's go to the farm and watch, you know, the cows eat and figure out what happens in a drought and how the milk is produced, how it affects the taste of chocolate or whatever, are just literally being hamstrung, not just by government imposed rules, regulations, and administrative burden, but by parents who are far too involved. I mean, our parents were like, go play in the traffic, right? You know, when it's supper time, come home. We had the freedom to do stuff, you know, like, and in today's world, there's a government issue, there's a work issue and an organization issue, there's a kid issue and technology issue, but, you know, there's also a parent issue that we need to tackle. I mean, what did I say to you the other day? All these Gen Zs taking their
pay mom and
parents
dad
to
some job
interviews.
Interviews,
I was like, you have got to be joking. This must be fake news.
I think you're very right on that. And that is like the trilogy, right? Is the parents, the government, and then sort of the classroom environment. What's happened, there's, I don't want to call it abdication of parents because I don't think it's been sort of a chosen, yeah. They haven't chosen that path, but this is that whole thing of, you know, this is the product. And I think it's, they are also a product of a system. And this is why each generation seems to get more and more watered down. And then parents, young parents now who are having kids seem to be more, even more helicoptering and more involved maybe than they should be. I say that lightly because I want parents to be involved, but you also want parents to understand what's happening in the classroom. And involvement means supporting the teacher and the child without overtaking the whole scenario. It's interesting to know because when I walked into the school now, I have a very supportive principal, and she has, because of all of this, she's offered, I'm also dysgraphic. So there's a lot of stuff in terms of like what I can, can't do functionally with admin tasks and stuff. And so she's almost lightened the load for me and taken a lot of that stuff off my plate so that I can do the creative, the learning with the kids and build on that. And it's worked out really well. But I know a lot of teachers, again, don't have that support system. This is the first time in 15 years I've had it. So it's amazing for me. But even helping with fielding parents in that regard, because I had to come in and explain to the parents what I was doing so that they didn't get a shock. First of all, this is my favorite. Since I've been a teacher, I've never believed in homework. And every year for 15 years, parents have asked why. Why don't I give homework? And then I have to explain that for me, homework can cause massive ruptures in your child's view of schooling. And so you come home, you've just cognitively in your brain, the kids are, they always say like sponges, but they are. They've absorbed all this information. Now they just need to be kids. Now they come home and they have to do more schoolwork for what? It's like oversaturation. Then the parents know, okay, I have to make the child do the homework. So let's sit down. Johnny's uncomfortable, doesn't want to do homework. Mom's like, do it, do it, do it. The next thing, there's a fight. Now we hate homework. Foundation phase, everybody's in tears. Nobody wants to do spelling. Now we don't spell anymore. It's this massive rupture, which affects the trajectory of schooling. And it sounds dramatic, but it's these little fractures that happen every year, every day, between the family dynamic, you know, mom and child, and then also the view of school. I just 100% believe that homework from, you know, grade R to maybe grade 9 is not necessary unless it's literally consolidating what was done in class. And even then, it shouldn't take more than 10 minutes because then you're wasting everybody's time. And so to have to explain this to parents year in, year out, does take a lot of massaging. Some parents are like, yes, best answer ever, because they don't want to have to deal with the fallout. And then the other parents who are very clearly the product of their system too are like, but why? Like, my child's going to fail. And then come this exam season, I didn't send work home for the kids to study because I was like, there's nothing that I'm going to put in that exam that you need to study for, because I believe you've learned everything in class application that you need to know how to do. But there was pressure from parents. So I created a little one-page study guide just to go over maybe some terminology for the kids to remember. And that seemed to settle them. But I remember thinking, this is so odd, as I'm not a parent, so I don't want to speak too blasé about it. But I would think as a parent, this would make me so happy because now my kid can run around and be a kid and do what they need to do. The teacher's given me confidence that my child's going to do well. Let's go with that. And then, this is just to plug myself, but then we wrote that exam and I had actually, unbeknownst, because I'd made it four sections, I'd made it a bit too long for what the school had structured for exam season. So I had to chop back. I took out a section, and without realizing, this is naughty, naughty of me, I had given them an exam that was set to level 4 and 5 of Bloom's taxonomy, which is all analyze and a critique essentially of what's happening. And so those are the really, that's like the big part, right? So the very cognitive aspect of it. And I had removed a lot of the
basics.
Yeah, like the easy marks. Stuff, yeah. The easy marks. And my class average, again, remedial school, was 54%. So that for me was astronomical. Again, I knew they could do it, but I was still surprised by that number, that no one bombed. And I had kids that did exceptionally well, but then the median was 54%.
Which and is so, way more than our pass rate.
Exactly.
There are two topics. One, just the advent of AI and technology in schools. I think a lot of countries are kind of removing it so that kids can start to think a little bit better. But the homework concept, I mean, if you speak to anyone in corporate, how many of those people are not doing homework at night, responding to emails, doing papers.
Yeah,
I mean, the advent, like,
for my corporate career of working in nights. Yeah.
You know, if I put myself in the shoes of parents who are working in corporate, so probably thinking, well, you know, how am I going to prepare my kid for a world of work where actually you're always on, you're always responding to emails, texts, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it goes back to some of the bullshit work that we speak about, Bron, like bullshit jobs of creating papers for governance, et cetera. People are consistently doing homework, and parents are consistently doing homework and needing to be at their desks instead of with their kids at night anyway. So, you know, perhaps there's something in that. And then the concept of commercialization in schools, like, are we not starting to run schools too much like businesses? And I think that's what's happened to a lot of our business schools as well, where our degrees 20 years ago mean very different to what degrees and that same piece of paper means today, is that, you know, there's a OT and a specialist. Everyone's going to an OT and everyone has to go and see a hearing specialist and everyone has to, like, there's a whole commercialization around revenue that's taking away potentially from the concept of schooling. And those two things combined, I think, are quite a conundrum for us to deal with. And it goes all the way back into work. It's almost like many corporates are these education systems, which is part of why our parents, I think, are pushing back on homework, for example.
But schools have always been a training ground for the function of society that those children are supposed to move into. What the problem is at the moment, and schools, always it's always been artificial. It's never been entirely human. It's never really been about the best interests of the individual. It's always been designed to give you a product of that system that is able to function in what that society they're going to have to live in is, as flawed as that might be. But the problem is, the world of work is shifting faster than the world of education can shift now. So now we are both producing unhappy people in an inhuman mold.
Yeah.
At least previously that would secure you a JOB and some sort of financial security. Now you're not getting a JOB out of that system either. So now you are, first of all, squashing children into a rigorous system, into a sausage factory, but for a world that no longer eats meat.
Exactly.
And then, by the way, the training departments in said environments are also sausage factories pushing you through leadership programs, et cetera, that teach you skills they think are going to make a difference and actually don't in the end when your balance sheet is responding to a market where value is being defined by your customer and not by yourself.
And like in education, your value is being defined of how well you could fit the format compliance, right? So in education, you do well if you are good at format. So if you can write an essay that looks a very specific way, you could match it to the rubric, great, you've done well. But then you ask someone in 6 months what they wrote and they're like, I don't know. Like, why would I know what I wrote? And so this is what's also being rewarded, because that also is rewarded to some degree in industry, like the whole Deloitte thing in Australia, where nobody fact checked what came out of that. Everyone was like, cool, it looks good. The spelling's right.
These look like
it reads well.
It reads well. It must be
English is fair.
Perfect. And then that's what happens. And this, we are rewarding that system over and over again. And I think I don't work in, you know, industry, corporate, and but for me, that's also where the problem is, because I look at it like education has been always, it's like this monolith, this dinosaur throughout history that has refused to change what it does. So throughout history, it's stayed exactly the same. I mean, you walk into any classroom right now, everybody's still sitting in little rows looking at a board. But then you look at how other industries have changed and moved. I don't know who the people are. Sorry, I have these random facts and then I never know who the people were. This like shipping, how the whole shipping logistics thing changed. There was like one company who figured that out, like, oh, we can now store the things in crates and move them like this. But then that changed the entire logistics industry. And so people were evolving. Corporate is evolving. Like they're looking now for kids who can produce.
But
it's moving faster than education. And that's the problem, is that education just says, it just digs its heels in. And the more you bring stuff up, the more it's like, nope, we're just going to stay this way. I mean, I am quite passionate on both ends about AI, and I will quantify that, is that as a dysgraphic, it's been incredibly helpful for me in terms of, you know, my spelling and helping me organize my thoughts and things like that. But then there's that other side of like AI slop and people who just like say, write me this, and then it writes it and then they post it. They don't check it. There's that format compliance that's happening. So they're not working through it. And in schools, there's that vacillation of everybody use AI now because the whole world is using AI. And then suddenly nobody use AI. We can't use AI. It's breaking everybody's brains. But I think there needs to be a middle ground of what using technology looks like. If I could give you another anecdote, for my first time teaching grade three was like, I'm trying to think, do the maths quickly. 7 years ago, I walked into my first grade three class at a very wealthy, beautiful private school in Cape Town. And I was already a bit strange for the parents there, but I'd settled in and we did a little project about biomes. And, you know, I went through my methods of how do we learn this? And I said, okay, cool. At the end of it, you're going to build a biome, but then at the end, I want you to give a presentation on it. You have to learn how to speak in front of a group, and this is fine. I'm going to ask you questions about it. You talk about your little biome, your poster, all of that. A little boy came up. His biome looked like he kind of did it the morning of, which was fine. Like that, I could tell who he was. That was kind of his vibe. But then his presentation like knocked me out of the park. And this is the thing. We don't look at children holistically. Like, yes, you might be really bad at the format again, but then oration, speaking, communicating, you're brilliant at, but where does that fit within the framework of the school? I can't penalize you for making a bad project if you speak so beautifully. And he did this whole thing about the Pacific Northwest tree octopus. And I was enthralled. I lived in the Pacific Northwest. I was like, wow, this is amazing. How come I never saw one? And he carried on and he spoke and he had his sources because I taught them how to reference, you know, in their little grade three way. Went to break and I was like, this is strange. I never saw one of those when I was there. And I did a lot of hiking. So I quickly Googled, true as Bob. I looked up his sources. It was all like fake news, like prank little websites. And this is 7 years ago. So Google was still, you know, not what it is now, no AI. And so I called him back in and I was like, oh, so now I can't necessarily mark you on your accuracy. But it was a beautiful learning experience to say to him, look, you spoke so beautifully. I can't penalize you for that. But this was not factual. And as a teacher, I can step in that gap and help you because now I know I need to teach you guys more about how to use the internet accurately and responsibly. And that was for me like a really defining moment when AI did come out is how do I handle kids with AI now? It's not necessarily having access to the technology that teaches you how to use it, but it's those cognitive abilities. How do you critically think about using it around you? So now at this school, the kids don't even have computers. It's not even a thing. They go like once a week on a Friday, a little bit of a 30-minute, like switch the computer on, switch it off, that kind of thing. But I knew someone would use AI at home. And so I created this little AI declaration form, not to catch them out, but just to, I want to understand their thinking. Why did they use AI? And one little boy confessed without knowing that he had used AI. And when I got his project, immediately the format was there. It was bullet pointed, you know, the typical AI standard, stock standard format, beautifully written. And when I looked at his AI declaration, he owned up to using it. And my question was, how did you know what the AI gave you was correct? Because I want them to test their thinking around this. And he wrote, me and my adults looked at it and the spelling was right. It was all correct. And so I thought, this is what kids are learning again over and over.
As long as the spelling is right. I mean, I have had a couple of corporate clients who get so frustrated and in a country where we have multiple languages when somebody's papers don't read correctly. The English is so, you know, rubbish and I have to rewrite everything that they give me. And that's not really the point, right? Mm. Is the outcome that is being communicated the right one?
Yes.
Mm. We've just got mini-me's everywhere.
But that, yeah, and we're training them. And this is that whole thing of, like you were saying, you know, parents sitting at home doing homework themselves about, it just really struck me what you said about training them to be used to being on call. We shouldn't all be on call all the time. That is also abnormal. It shouldn't be the way life is. You should be able to go home, you know, a deadline, whatever the case is, do a little bit of work, switch off your phone and walk away. But that's not what's happening. And so we're training the wrong thing, like a feedback loop in a system. You're just raising the water level and nobody notices.
Well, that was my point. Like we are training people to fit in with the dysfunction of the society they're going to inherit. Mm. But the question then becomes for people like yourself and
how do
for
we
people
change the
like
society?
You, how do you breed or train a generation of children to challenge the system rather than to fit in with a system that's not going to actually reward them going forward?
Rebel.
What can be done practically though? Because all the incentives for parents, like Sharon was saying, and for corporations and for any system is to continue in its death throes, not to change. And the problem is by the time people are graduates going into graduate programs, a lot of that sort of cognitive damage or pattern making has been set. Mm-hmm. It's much more difficult to create a solutionist, Sharon, out of a 30-year-old who has just finished their second master's program and has been a complete product of the education system than it is to create a solutionist out of a 16-year-old who dropped out of school at 14, right? How do we reconcile those things? I think some of the work you're doing in trying to integrate curricula, you're still working within a very rigid system, but at least you're trying to get people to think beyond the box that is going to dictate the mark they're going to get, that's going to dictate the access going forward. Mm. But what are the key things that we have to be looking at if we're going to break those cycles? And from your side, Sharon, what can be done with people who are products of systems? And as a sort of real wake-up call, is it too late for a current generation of workforce, the current generation who's bringing mom and dad to their job interviews, that's struggling to fit into a career ladder that's breaking and shifting due to advances of the markets, of technology, of globalization? How do we correct that course? And is it, how realistic is it at this juncture for the current, say, generation of 18 to sort of 35-year-olds? Is this not going to be the biggest challenge we have? Because there are people like Esme in the system who are trying to fix the base pipeline. And of course, people who are not, we're not quite so entrenched into quite so many years of education, like yourself and myself, a little bit older. We weren't the product of the of maximum education, which is kind of what we got at the moment, where people are studying for the first 20 years of their life before they're being released into the world and are expected to solve problems. Like how? Your brain is entirely fixed and set in a particular journey. Do you have any advice on solutions for the product of the current system? And do you have any advice or suggestions going forward as to how to scale out and roll out what you're trying to do? I know you are working on things both in the sort of startup space and also with how you challenging the system slowly, gently, one step at a time from within.
This is where the parents are also crucial. So even if you look at parental groups, I know they all, you know, there's always like a little parent group with play dates, doing things, you know, organizing stuff. It's for parents to also look at that and say, well, what is my child learning when they come home from school? Am I having decent discussions with them? Not just like, how was your day? You know, so things like, what did you learn today? What did that mean for you when you learned that? So being more reflective, I think, as a family, and making that more as a value system within a household, is that reflection rather than did you get A+ or did you get a C kind of thing. But I think even bigger than that is for there are teachers in the system who are doing this and who are fighting against it. And yeah, they just need to like keep rebelling, keep doing what they're doing and push back. I really believe at some point, you know, if you look at diffusion, you know, if you have a little jar of water and you pour some food coloring into it, it is going to change the color of the water. It might just not happen as quick as we'd want it to happen or our hope wants it to happen, but it will change. And to, yeah, if you know a teacher, to support them in that and encourage them in that. And I do think from more of a policy level that industry, higher education, and even, you know, grade R to 12 need to discuss things more. They need to they need to be in more meetings together at the same table, you know? I think that would be helpful.
The art of talking.
Yeah.
Some of us do really well. Yeah, Bron, I think the problem is a complicated one. And I think I want to just take a step back and put myself in the shoes of each of those elements of the circle. So if we think about organizations, you and I have said consistently, the way in which they have traditionally structured with hierarchies and jobs and silos has to be challenged. And I think what's happening is the economic environment, the geopolitical environment, the rising costs, falling profits, higher competition, you know, is starting to AI, technology evolution, all of that stuff is starting to surface the fact that we are not efficient and we are not effective and we are structured in a way that, you know, maybe perpetuates value extraction versus value delivery. And so there's pressure to sort of structure differently. And I think jobs themselves, how work is defined, how talent is defined, there's something that has to be done there. If I put myself in the shoes of parents, we have to bear in mind these parents are the same ones who are facing disruption in the construct of, well, am I relevant in the marketplace? Am I up for redundancy? Many are being laid off themselves, not able to progress. And now I've got kids to feed, worry about, and produce for the same system that is now screwing me over. And how do you reflect and have those conversations when you're actually not capable of doing it yourself for yourself because it's happening? And then there's the government conundrum, which in the context of our world, you know, whether you take today's crisis of the Strait of Hormuz being closed, how do countries, you know, become independent of forces that allow us to create jobs and create better systems for teachers to live in? And there's this concept of how do we be independent? How do we produce different teachers? How do we produce new jobs? How do we produce work for people to do? Let's rather call it something else. And if those three things are not dealt with in collaboration, we're in trouble. So the education system itself, what it teaches, how it teaches, etc. So we talk about our solutionist model, being able to contextualize, diagnose, translate that diagnosis into something meaningful for those who need to receive it, create a solution, operationalize it, digitalize it, etc. has to be embedded in how organizations are designed, how parents themselves are evolving themselves, because, you know, leaving your kid to the technology, you know, things have advanced so much. Like my maths in sub A, it was nowhere near what the grade naught ones are doing today. So they are also outsourcing to AI. Trust me, they can't answer half the homework questions themselves. And then from a government perspective, how do we, you know, produce better teachers, but more importantly, what are we producing them for? And creating those economies. So I think the nature of work itself is probably where it starts, Bron, and what work is and what will work be in the future. In the, you know, do we need more technicians, plumbers, and how do we start to bring up the level of practical value adding, value deriving work to the same standard as it was years ago, whether you had a degree or whether you were an electrician, you were sort of on par. You weren't like a lesser god, you know. So I think the answer is multifaceted, and it's not in one space. And I think it starts with work, and work in the context of the solutionist model. It doesn't matter what you put in there. If we teach people to diagnose, contextualize, empathize, understand the world around them, solution, digitize, operationalize, and then relearn and unlearn on a continuous basis, it won't matter what the work is. That is the core skill.
I think there's something else that we need to look at that kind of, again, connects a lot of these dots. And that is, at the moment, education and work are seen as different steps and different stages. When you are under education, you are paying, you are valueless, and you have to pay in order to accumulate your value. And then you have to go into the world of work and jobs, and then you get paid and you are valuable. And I think a lot of what both of you are saying, the work that you've been looking at for many years, is that we need to re-kind of conflate the two. Mm-hmm. That in a healthy society, no matter your age or your stage in life, your work has value. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, children are working. They're working very hard, many times at longer hours than mom and dad, not only for no pay, for negative pay, right? Yeah. How do we make sure the work that that it's work that we are doing throughout, and that we are being valued and being valuable throughout? And that's what little projects, I know Charlie and the Chocolate Factory sounds silly, sounds cute, it's kids so making cute chocolate bars. It's not that. This is now valuable work that has an intrinsic component for the worker. And it's also hopefully valuable to society. Someone gets to eat that chocolate, even if it looks a bit, you know, flat. I know that's a silly example, but if you go back in time before our very artificial industrial education and economy that we have presently, the family works together to plow the land, to collect the eggs, to do the things. The work and education were in and of the same thing. You learned through doing, and you did something that was valuable while you were learning. Mm. And to sort of do that throughout our lives, that's exactly the same thing we've been trying to tell corporates. But we're starting already with this product that has been broken and molded in a very different space, which is why we need to connect these dots from earlier. That work has to come into education from an early age, and education has to come into work continually, that you never stop learning, of course, and all those sort of terrible cliches around learning and unlearning. But it's that same mindset that, is the work that I'm doing contributing? Is it valuable? Am I being valued as I go along? And am I constantly being able to adapt with the seasons of change as we go forward?
And what am I measuring? Work is measuring rote, activity, delivery of a thing, as opposed to value. In the same way as, I guess, education is doing. You get 90% because you can regurgitate the facts of something, you know, versus could you create a product that could be sold for value and deliver something intrinsic or extrinsic to somebody?
And even with that, it was really interesting because I had a lot of feedback from other teachers who are walking around who are like very new to this way of thinking and teaching. And the overwhelming feedback from them and parents were they were so amazed at how much the children in this 10 weeks, in the short amount of time, had digested the information that they had learned. So they weren't just standing there giving a presentation that they had practiced. Like you could literally throw any question at them about their sustainability or their ethical statements. Like how, why did they choose to pay the factory worker this and the farm worker that? And then how did they make profit? They could answer. And so it was this internalized understanding of what these interconnected systems meant. And so yes, they walked away with a really cool skill of chocolates, which I think they're going to kill their parents this holiday with having made. But then this other understanding of what that means for the world around them, because we have this thing called the classroom economy, which is, I don't love, what do you call those things like, oh, you did so well, here's a sweetie, a reward system.
Yeah.
But I have more of
Pavlovian education.
Yes. Yeah. So I want more of a
gold star.
Exactly.
People of the week.
I want like a democratic system for these kids. I want them to understand what that would mean. And so we developed a fiat economy. They designed their own money and they drew on it. And amazingly, the kid that did the design, he loves design, he went around and he tried to figure out symbols that meant something to us as a class, which for me was like mind-blowing because if you've ever, you know, people don't necessarily walk around thinking about why.
Empathize.
Yeah, but why certain symbols are on money. That's not what normal people think about on a day-to-day basis. But he took that and he was like, well, South Africa has the rhino for this and the la, 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 la. So I'm going to put this on there and then develop this beautiful currency. And so once a week, they get a wage from me with a little wage slip that tells them, this is how much you earn for your job. This is what I'm taking for UIF because we do have some unemployed kids and they get paid. But they also get taxed, how much I'm taking off of tax, why. And then I've explained where the tax goes. They pay rent for their desk and their table. And it's this beautiful situation where, and then they can spend their money on certain things, which they love. But even through that, as a teacher, as a practitioner, I've then seen certain kids that where they need the support in life. So some kids are keep all their money. They're just saving all the time, hoarding, hoarding. Other kids, by the time they get paid, 2 hours later in class, they've spent all their money. And that for me is a diagnostic then. How do I then help these kids for future? You probably need to learn how to steward money and what it means to budget and how, you know, and also like pleasure versus perseverance, all of those things. And it sounds really silly maybe from the outside, but those are the types of things that like teachers can also do to understand their kids and where their kids are sitting on what spectrum and how to help them. But it's the most fascinating thing of that whole thing, just to go back to the democracy, is when I said, okay, what type of jobs? Because we have to get paid for doing something. You can't just get paid. And the majority of them said that the kids who are cleaning the class, so like the sweeping, cleaning the board, picking up the trash, they should get more because nobody wants to do those jobs. And I was like, wow, if that's only crazy. Adults thought like that. And exactly. I just thought it was beautiful. And so now the trash keepers, all of those people are like the most esteemed in the class. And then we've got like a lawyer because we have a judiciary system. And they get paid like a very set salary, you know, unless somebody wants to hire a different lawyer because we work on restorative justice. And so it's this whole little democratic economy happening in this class. And it seems fun and frivolous, but like I can see what's developing in these boys is they're learning a sense of justice. Like
social consciousness.
Yes. In the beginning, they just wanted everybody to be like punished. They were like, punish, punish, take his money, like pay a fine, pay a fine. Now they sit back and they start to ask really intelligent questions in the courtroom about why the person, what was the behavior that led that person to do this infraction? And what did that look like, you know? And it's fascinating for me to watch.
Sounds like I want to come and watch too.
Well, it sounds like that's a good place to try and kind of wrap this up. I think the general purpose of this conversation is that that solutioning mindset needs to start from cradle and continue through your contribution to society, and that we acknowledging for our corporate clients and listeners and for the people who are products of the education system, that what we're asking people to do is not easy, Sharon. We're asking people to shift into a solutioning mindset when they have been bred and brought up and conditioned and paid large amounts of money to fit into a much more linear system that simply does not exist. So that's both the bad news and the good news, that there's a better way, that it certainly sounds a lot more fun to be in Esme's class than it was to sit in probably the school system that you went to from anywhere from 12 to 20 years, depending on how wealthy and privileged your parents were. And that going forward, this journey doesn't stop though at the end of school, that you've got to continue exercising those solutioning muscles, which hopefully you'll continue to do by continuing to listen to this particular show and to read our book. We do know that there's problems out there. We've also created our own diagnostics to help you figure out what it is that you need to work on. And we're certainly going to be working on products and services and tools to help you develop those muscles in your adult life, because it's going to be essential going forward. Sharon, what do you have to say to close today?
Join the solutionist movement and let's change the world one conversation at a time.
Thank you for joining us for today's corporate therapy session. If you want the solutionists to solve a workplace dilemma with you, contact us at survivetheaiapocalypse.com.
Welcome to the solutionist movement.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.